Hello, and welcome to episode 136 of the Sea Control Podcast, hosted by the Center for International Maritime Security. My name is Matthew Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. And on this episode, Roger Misso, SimSec's vice president, makes his Sea Control hosting debut by interviewing Ray Mavis, the previous Secretary of the Navy in the Obama administration. The discussion examines how he became SecNav, how he dealt with the job, and all of those interesting things that he learned along the way. We'll get started with this eye-opening interview after a brief word about our organization.
SimSec brings you the best content on maritime security, technology, history, and international affairs. Sign up to become a member today by visiting www.cimsec.org/about/membership. Join us today.
Hi, my name is Roger Misso, and I'm pleased to bring you another edition of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. And in true SimSec tradition, we'll ask our distinguished guest who's here with us to introduce himself and to tell us about himself in just a few words.
My name's Ray Mavis. I'm the immediate past Secretary of the Navy, longest serving since World War I, from 2009 to January 20th. 2017.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. It's an honor, and we're really privileged that you joined us here today. We're excited to talk to you and learn about your time as Secretary of the Navy. So, really, the first question I have for you is, a lot of people know how admirals and generals are promoted. They know how senators and governors and presidents are elected, but they don't necessarily know how service secretaries and political appointees are made. So I was wondering if you could tell us the story of how you became Secretary of the Navy. Is it something you asked for? Is it something that someone suggested to you? And how did that come about?
Well, in 2007, in March of 2007, I endorsed a relatively unknown Illinois senator named Barack Obama for president and went out and did 300 events for him. I was his most traveled surrogate ever. And when he won the election, his transition team called me and said, would you like to come into the administration? And I said, well, it depends on the job. And they said, well, do you have anything in mind? And I said, I want to be Secretary of the Navy. And they said, well, okay, what's your second choice? And I said, that's pretty much it. Nice. And I'd always thought that Secretary of the Navy, because I'd been in the Navy years earlier, 37 years earlier, in fact, right. From I was commissioned in 69, got out in 72. But I always thought Secretary of the Navy was probably the best appointed job in government. I had the best elective job as governor of Mississippi, but in terms of appointed jobs, it's so big. It's got a global reach. You can have a huge impact on large numbers of people, on big policies, on things that happen in the world. And so that's why I wanted it. No, it came from me. Turns out, I found out it was the most requested job in the Obama administration.
No kidding.
And so that's how political appointees get made. I think most people believe you've had to serve, but I was the first secretary since the early 90s that had served in any branch of the military, but particularly in the Navy. John Dalton, who had been secretary from 93 to 97, was a Naval Academy graduate, but everybody in between, nobody had served.
Well, you mentioned you're the longest serving SecNav, at least since World War II. World War I. 2,803 days as secretary, according to Wikipedia, at least, which is ironclad information.
It's always true.
That's right. So as the longest serving SecNav, as you think back on your time, what do you maybe wish you knew at the beginning of your tenure that you didn't know then? And conversely, what do you wish you could change towards the end of your time that you realize you couldn't?
Well, I'll take the first part of the question a little differently.
Sure.
I thought one of the great strengths I brought to Navy was I didn't know what the issues were. But I also didn't bring any baggage. So I could take a fresh look. And I think that's valuable, not just in Navy, but anywhere, that occasionally you need to bring in people from completely outside that can look and see what's important that you may, because of just the day-to-day stuff, looking down, making sure that you're getting the inbox cleaned out, making sure that you're doing the stuff you need to do that day, you don't step back and say, well, what's important here? And I thought that was, as I said, a great strength coming in. And the Pentagon does a really good job of getting you ready for your confirmation hearings and for your job, because for several weeks in a windowless room in the Pentagon in 1 hour chunks from 8 a.m. until 5 p.m, I got briefed on what the Navy and the Marine Corps and the Department of the Navy were doing around the world. And as you listen to that, issues start popping up. And so I picked four. One of the lessons I learned as governor and in any of these leadership roles is you've got to narrow your focus. You can't try to do everything. So I picked people, our sailors and Marines, platforms, a number of ships, aircraft, systems that we had, power, the energy that to do the things we needed to do with our ships, with our aircraft, and partnerships internationally and partnerships with the American people. In terms of the second part of your question, there were some things that I wish I'd started working on earlier, because it really does take a long time to get some things done. And one of the things is loosening up the promotion process, allowing people to not have a traditional career path, because I think that too many times we get into this check the box things, where now with big data, with analytics, with metrics, you can, if somebody comes in from a very different way, you can categorize that, you can value that. And so if somebody, you know, misses their department head tour or something, it may be that they're out doing something else that was at least as valuable, maybe more valuable to the Navy if we can keep them in. Along those lines, started the career and a mission program so that you can take up to 3 years off. But I do wish that I had started some of these, particularly these personnel initiatives, a little sooner. I started them probably 3 years in. And it just takes, as you know, a long, long time for some of these to come to fruition. You've got to go through several cycles. You've got to give people a heads up. You got to make sure that careers aren't harmed by people who were under the old system. And now I think it's going to happen, and I think it is happening in Navy. But I wouldn't change anything that I did. I might have started a couple of things earlier.
Good. In 2,803 days, you worked under four different Secretaries of Defense. Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, Secretary Hagel, and Secretary Carter. Did your job differ at all under those four SecDefs? And how did their different leadership styles maybe affect the Navy?
Well, first, my job didn't change. The Navy is so big. The Department of the Navy is so big. If we were a private company, second biggest in the country in terms of employees after Walmart, third biggest in terms of asset in between ExxonMobil and Berkshire Hathaway, fifth biggest in terms of budget authority, $170 billion budget, about 900,000 people. And so because you're so big and because the service secretaries are the operators, recruit, train, and equip, be the people buying the things, training people, furnishing the equipment and the people that the combat commanders need. Secretary of Defense and DOD writ large is more, to me, more policy, more advice to the president, more of that role, and not the direct operator role, which is why I think a service secretary's job, particularly the Secretary of the Navy, is a far better job than Secretary of Defense, for example. You do have, because you are so big, you do have so much autonomy there. Now, I'm not going to get into individual personalities here.
Sure.
But the one thing I will say is that the lessons of leadership that I've learned over a career in government and the private sector is that they're exactly true for the Secretary of Defense or a service secretary. You got to focus on a few things that you can get done. You've got to be willing to let go. You can't micromanage. If you're the smartest person in the room, you're probably in the wrong room. you need to get good people, give fairly clear direction, which came from the president, basically, and then hold people accountable. I mean, the only one personality thing I will get into is Bob Gates, when he was Secretary of Defense, before I got there. Bob Gates never raised his voice, was, as far as I could tell, always calm. Yet he fired Secretary of the Air Force, a Secretary of the Army, a Chief of Staff of the Air Force, and a Chief of Staff of the Army. Mm-hmm. And I think part of leadership is, you know, you don't get heated up, you don't yell and scream and this sort of stuff, but you do hold people accountable. And I always thought that brand of leadership, that calm, steady leadership, but then actually taking action. Not particularly Secretary of Defense, but you see these people yelling all the time, I'd fire those people if that. He actually did it. And not in terms of firing people, although I did that from time to time, but in terms of trying to be a responsible leader that had people under me, tried to give clear direction and then say, go do it. I will hold you accountable, but I'm not going to get in your business day in and day out.
That's a great lesson, I think, for everybody to take away, certainly one that applies regardless of rank or position or title. Currently, Secretary Stackley is the acting Secretary of the Navy, but we don't have a new appointed Secretary of the Navy yet. When that person, if that person does come along, what advice might you have for them?
Well, first, Sean Stackley is terrific. He was there with me the entire time I was there. But he is an acquisition specialist. And I think Sean will be the first person to tell you that what he loves and what he wants to get back to is acquiring things, is doing the negotiations, is doing what he is unsurpassed at. And I think the fact that it's 5 months into an administration almost, and you haven't had anybody even nominated to be Secretary of the Navy, is just terrible. The lack of direction, because, you know, there was an acting when I came in, but he had only been acting for about 6 weeks.
Right.
But even in that 6 weeks, he had decisions that he had to make. Now, B.J. Penn was the acting, and he was terrific at it. He didn't make a decision that he thought belonged rightfully to the permanent Secretary of the Navy. He would just say, I'm not going to do this because I'm not going to, you may not agree with it, which I think is right. Sean is in the same position. He's got to make decisions, but he doesn't know which direction the new secretary, whoever that may be, wants to go in. And with the confirmation process and with Senate schedule, I mean, even if somebody's nominated today, it's probably going to be September, October before they're confirmed. I mean, realistically.
Yeah.
And so you don't know. But I guess the things that I would say, number one, the things that I did in terms of the four P's that I mentioned, people, platforms, power, partnerships, I did to make us better warfighters. I did to, you know, because we're going to alternative energy, fewer people are going to die. We were losing a Marine killed or wounded for every 50 convoys of fuel we brought into Afghanistan. Because of the personnel moves, of opening everything to women, of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, we're stronger. A more diverse force is a much stronger force. And don't look at it in ideological terms. Look at it in, is it working? And is it making the Navy and Marine Corps better warfighters? Because it can be proved that all four of those things are. Second, pick your own stuff. I mean, every secretary is different, and they should be.
Yeah.
But always have that touchstone that if it's not making the Navy and Marine Corps better, if it's not making them better warfighters, if it's not making them better at their job, which is protecting this country, then why are you doing it? And the third thing is you're going to have to keep one eye on today because of the things that are happening today. But if you don't keep an eye on 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and the quick example I'll give you is in 2001, the U.S. Navy had 316 ships. By 2008, 7 years later, after one of the great military buildups in our history, we were down to 278. In those 7 years, the Navy only put 41 ships under contract. My seven budget years, I put 86 ships under contract, more than twice what they did. Now, the day I left, there were 274 ships in the fleet. Because of the decisions that had been made 10, 15, 20 years earlier, and we'll get back to 308 ships, which is what we were building toward, by 2021, which is not that far away, 4 years away. And I guarantee you, whoever the Secretary of the Navy is then, whoever the President is then, will say, look what I did. Look at this. We got to 308 ships.
Yeah.
But if whoever comes in as Secretary of the Navy now doesn't continue building ships at this high rate, doesn't keep doing it year in, year out, then the Secretary of the Navy and the President in 2030, in 2035, won't have the fleet that they will need to have to do the things that they need to do. It takes a long time to build a fleet. It takes a long time to reverse a decline. And if you don't pay attention to it every year, and it won't happen when you're there. Nothing the next Secretary will do, even if they stay there, you know, like I did almost 8 years, you won't see it in terms of platforms in particular while you're there. But you've got to do it. You've got to do it for the Navy, you've got to do it for the Marine Corps, and you've got to do it for the country.
Yeah. I think there was a sign on Joe Rochefort's desk that said, it doesn't matter, there's no limit to what we can do together so long as no one cares who gets the credit.
Right.
So that seems pretty applicable here. We've talked about the Secretary of the Navy. We've sort of talked about the President. Do you think there are ways the Navy can strengthen its relationship with Congress? Are there things we can do better, different approaches, that sort of thing?
Well, I think one of the main things that the Navy or any federal agency needs to do with Congress is be completely upfront, completely transparent, not try to hide the ball. Bad news doesn't get better if somebody else finds it out first. And just engage with them a lot. I mean, I found that was one of the things that that was the most helpful, is getting to know members as individuals, getting to know them. And again, this was a pretty nonpartisan job. I mean, the military ought to be a little separate from politics and from partisanship. And so, whether somebody's a D or an R, hill shouldn't really matter. And you shouldn't just talk to the people in your party, regardless of which party that is. But there's, I mean, people in Congress, number one, they want to do the right thing, I think, more times than not. Number two, they need the information, and they need to, because they're the ones appropriating the money, you've got to show to them that you're tackling fraud and abuse, that you're not asking for money that isn't going to be well spent. And so I think that transparency, along with some actual substance in terms of what you're doing, makes all the difference.
Nice. There's a unique challenge, as you well know, between inspiring change and then managing change to produce results eventually. I think you tried to tackle this, especially as it related to your innovation vision. How do leaders do this? How did you manage the difference between inspiration, inspiring the force, and actually creating change and seeing it through to the end? And do you think that, as you look back, the innovation vision has been a success so far?
I'll answer the last one first. Yes, I do.
Good.
Some of the things that we're doing now, every time we put a ship in the yard, we change the light bulbs. That was a suggestion from a chief. It saves a destroyer 20,000 gallons of fuel a year to change light bulbs to LEDs.
It's crazy.
And it's better light, and you don't have to change the bulbs, but every 7 years instead of every 6 months, the way we do today. And you don't have to break out the scaffolds and things like hangar decks and stuff like that. But I think there are several things. One is, first, you've got to come up with the idea. You've got to come up with the inspiration. And it's got to be clear, and you've got to talk about it all the time. Whatever that is, whether it's innovation is a general thing, or whether it's one of the specific programs that I mentioned. And you got to repeat it over and over and over again so that people know that the leadership is committed, that if they go out on a limb in their career or in their job, they're gonna have some top cover to do that. Second, you've got to get people on the deck plates, people who are actually out there involved. And there are lots of ways to do it. We did a crowdsourcing platform in innovation. We set up Task Force Innovation, which people compete for to get on. And it's a year tour. It's going to help your career if you've been on it. You work on one project, you do a deep dive for a year, and you come out with recommendations. Three is, you actually have to, as a leader, when somebody recommends something or when it bubbles up through this innovation process, you got to fund it. You got to show people that, and then you have to recognize people. And you've got to explain to people over and over and over again, not that this is a great theory, but this is how it's going to affect you. This is how it's going to affect your life. This is why it's going to make you better at your job. This is why it'll make the Navy and Marine Corps better. Better warfighters, better at what they do. We're not just doing this for drill. We're not just doing this because it's a great idea. We're doing it for a purpose, and here's that purpose. And then when somebody comes up with one of these great ideas, recognize them. Recognize them in front of their peers, recognize them to the leadership, to show people we really will listen.
Last question. You mentioned the governor of Mississippi is your best elected job. Secretary of the Navy, your best appointed job. What's next? What's the next job? What's the next task for you after having been Secretary of the Navy for so long?
Well, I like change. I like being an agent of change. I like to be disruptive in a good sort of way. And so I like building more than I like maintaining. I like the things that you have to do. So I'm an advisor now to Google Ventures in terms of what comes next.
Nice.
I'm helping several pre-IPO companies. And how do you manage growth? How do you instill a culture? How do you keep that culture as you're getting bigger? How do you create a narrative about what you're up to? Because one thing, it doesn't matter that you're doing the right thing if nobody knows you're doing the right thing,
right?
particularly the people who work with you, then it's not useless, but it's not as powerful as it should be. And so I just finished teaching at Harvard Law School, Harvard Business School, and Harvard Kennedy School, and that was a wonderful experience. I'm going to continue at the business school off and on this fall. But it's what's over the horizon. It's what's next. It's what technology or what idea is going to change this country, going to change the world for the better. That's what I want to be involved in. I'll end with a Navy story. I was in Asia talking to a head of Navy there. And he said the difference in soldiers and sailors is that the Army looks down. They look at maps. They see boundaries. They see obstacles. The Navy looks out. They see the horizon. They don't see any boundaries. They don't see any obstacles. And they want to see what comes next. And it's a different mindset if you join the Navy or the Marines than it is if you do anything else. And I like to think that's my mindset. I want to see what's over the horizon. I want to see what comes next. I've got that Navy and Marine Corps curiosity and mindset.
Well, that's something we can certainly all take to heart, Mr. Secretary. It was an honor to have you join us today, and I'm really looking forward to what's next for you, for our Navy, and for everyone in it. So thank you very much.
Me too. Thank you.
That concludes episode 136 of the Sea Control Podcast from the Center for International Maritime Security. I'm Matt Marighi, your senior producer for Sea Control. Special thanks to our host, Roger Misso, our guest, Secretary Mavis, and our producer, Ryan Yulia. If you enjoyed this podcast and you haven't already yet subscribed to Sea Control, please do. Subscribing gives you automatic access to all of our episodes as they become available. And if you really like us, go on over to iTunes, give us a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends to tune in. Thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time on Sea Control.